Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome to episode 445 with my guest Murph. This is a rerun of an episode recorded in 2011. I think it was maybe our second episode ever, or maybe our fourth episode, very, very early on. The month of July here is a best of collection. As I'm taking some much needed time off, I'll be back next week, our first week in August, be back to releasing new episodes. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp.com. If you've never tried online counseling, you should definitely check it out. I really love doing it. It's so nice not to leave my house. My therapist helps me work through a lot of stuff very gently, and she's very wise and compassionate. So if you want to check it out, go to betterhelp.com/mental and then fill out a questionnaire. And if they have a counselor they think is a good fit for you, they'll match you up with one. And then you can experience a free week of counseling to see if online counseling is a good fit for you. And you need to be over 18. Today's episode is sponsored by Crazed. It's a new podcast created by the National Mental Health Innovation Center, and it highlights big new ideas in the world of mental health, from how to transform mental health treatment to prevention and stigma reduction, and the visionaries behind these ideas. The two hosts are Matt Vogel and Rick Rekedahl. Matt is the founder and executive director of the NMHIC and also a former professional stand-up. And Rick is, or was, the senior executive at DreamWorks Animation. And their guests are familiar with the impact of mental health, both personally and professionally. And you'll find compelling stories, information about cutting-edge mental health technology, and just great dialogue about difficult issues. Guests include policymakers, nonprofit leaders, researchers, technologists, filmmakers, and more. And the ideas and stories presented on Crazed are the kind that you dig and will probably be talking about long after you've heard the episode. So you can find Crazed anywhere you get your podcasts or on crazedpodcast.com. Subscribe and listen today. And here now is the episode from 2011 with my guest Murph.
Welcome again to the Mental Illness Happy Hour. I am sitting here with my friend Murph, who I'm going to call him Murph because I think it would make him more comfortable to just use his nickname than to get into I think it will be easier for you to answer honestly the questions about your past if we just go with your your nickname. It's funny because when I met you, Murph, about, what was it, 5 years ago? We have a mutual friend, Jamie, who introduced us. And you're somebody that I looked at you and I said, this guy's been to prison. This guy is not to be fucked with. But there's something about this guy that I really like and I want to get to know. And it's funny because here, 5 years later, you're somebody that I feel so safe around, whose company I enjoy so much. I'm sitting here in a house that you share with a beautiful woman. You guys are both in recovery. You've both been sober. You've been sober for 5 years, mm-hmm. right? Yep. She's been sober for 20 years. You have this beautiful house together. And I was you were showing me around the house, and I'm in your walk-in closet, and it occurs to me you used to live in a room no bigger than that walk-in closet in That's prison. It. How many years did you do in prison?
It's around 15. I had an 8, a 5, and a 4, and then a couple of little ones, uh-huh. parole violations. And,
yeah. What were the big ones for?
The first one was an attempted murder. The second one was a battery with great bodily injury. And the third one was also, let's just say a hands-on crime.
Okay. All right.
Another hands-on crime.
Am I safe in saying that, and I think I've heard you say this before, none of your crimes were ever committed against women or children. Not that that makes it any better, but for some people, I think there's a line, where, your crimes were never of a sexual nature. They were mostly for money to feed your drug habit. Is that,
right,
am I correct in
right.
that?
I don't, yeah. Women and children, war and sex crimes is
okay,
you know, below the line.
Okay.
I came from the school of, if you're gonna take, you take from someone who, in my twisted head, should be able to protect themselves.
Yeah.
And if they can't,
yeah.
well, then they shouldn't have what they have.
Yeah.
That's how I used to think. I don't yes. think that way anymore.
I'm glad because, I was doing, as soon as I started doing this podcast, I thought Murph would be a great person to have on this podcast because he has a history that if you looked at it, you would say this person's either a psychopath or a sociopath because there seemed to be no empathy towards his victims. He took what he wanted, and you started. Was it safe to say by the age of 15 you were committing crimes?
It was probably 16.
Okay.
From the age of, you know, from my birth to 16, I was in, you know, I mean, I come from a good family. I was instilled with all of the things.
And that's the part that blows my mind, is you come from this kind of warm, nurturing
yeah.
family, and you chose this life of, is that just the drug addict in you, you think? That you...
I don't...
How did you...
I don't know how it happened.
Take me back to your childhood. Tell me, give me some snapshots from your childhood that you think would help paint a picture for the listener to understand.
Well, I grew up in a middle class, Roman Catholic, hardworking, Irish, upbringing, in Brooklyn, New York, and around the New York City area. And I had all of the, you know, all of the things that you're supposed to have growing up. There was toys under the tree at Christmas. There was Little League. There was peewee football. There was church. There was Cub Scouts. There was Boy Scouts. There was all of that. And there was family vacations. There was a summer house. There was a winter house in the city. It was all pretty normal. It was kind of like a 1960s Brady Bunch existence.
Mm-hmm.
Mom was always home. Dad worked. It was pretty normal. There was pets. You know, I got two brothers and a sister. And things were pretty normal while you know, sports was a big thing for me. I played all sports. When, you know, when one ended, another one began. Mm-hmm. It was all about the sports. That's what I did. How it all went, I don't know. I guess when I started to get a little bit more freedom, and I grew up in a neighborhood where I would look out and I'd see older guys in the neighborhood. Mm. And I was just drawn to what they were doing.
They seemed to have power.
Yeah.
People looked up to them. They were afraid of them.
They had cars. They had girls. Mm-hmm. And they never seemed to work. Mm-hmm. And my dad would go off to work. He was gone before I would get up in the morning. And he'd come home, you know, at 7 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of like, you know, those guys, they had jewelry. And mm-hmm. I was like, you know, I didn't grow up wanting to be, you know, despite my upbringing, I didn't grow up wanting to be the policeman, the fireman, the astronaut, the, you know, naval mm-hmm. commander. Yeah. I wanted to be one of those guys.
Right. And do you think the fact that you were small for your age and, you know, had red hair, do you think that made it more alluring to be one of those guys that you would feel safer being one of those guys?
Well, I absolutely do, because it had, you know, it was a, I also had a bad speech impediment while growing up. So not only did I have the orange hair and the freckles, I had a stuttering problem too. So I never felt comfortable and I was never included.
Yeah.
You know, I always felt different, and, you know, I mean, you know how kids are when we're young, they're quite cruel.
Right.
So there was a lot of taunting and a lot of, you know, and I just didn't,
At what age did you, become, because you work out, you're, a fit guy, you're muscular, you're somebody that I look at and say, that guy's not to be fucked with. At what age did you transition from the kid getting picked on to the guy not to be fucked with?
Well, you know, I'm not really sure, and I don't even really recall the years that my stuttering problem spanned. Mm-hmm. But I know that it was probably fifth grade through the seventh grade. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately for me, I learned during that period that if I couldn't get you to stop doing what you were doing to me through communication, mm-hmm. I learned very quickly that I could get you to stop if I imposed my will upon you, or if you were, you know, that big, if I picked something up and whack you with it.
Really? So you went the crazy route. You kind of said, well, I'll just be crazier than everybody and I'll intimidate them.
Well, I don't know if it was a conscious thought, but I just wanted the teasing to stop so bad that I was willing to do anything to make it stop.
You know, you remind me of a friend of mine also from New York who was small for his age, and he said that his secret was he would just go further than everybody else. He would be at a bar, and if it looked like it was going to come to a fight, he would break a bottle over his own head and say, come on, motherfuckers. And he said, you can't believe how many people that would back down. And he comes from a family. He told me a story one time where some bigger kids had stolen his bike, and he came home and he told his grandmother, and she said, and you didn't fight them? And he said, no. She said, why didn't you make them a sandwich too, you faggot? And I was like, wow, now I understand the breaking the bottle over the head. But your family wasn't like that. It sounds like your family was supportive, but it was, you know, that pressure of being the kid with the stutter and the red hair and wanting that power. So it was alluring, and that seemed like to you the path to safety, or to at least to happiness.
Well, I think this is, I think I figured it out over the years. What happened was I got sprung on the feeling of I can get what I want. Mm-hmm. If I push hard enough.
Right.
And if I, you know, I mean, if I do, you know, and I learned that I could solve my problems through violence, since I couldn't communicate.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, that, it didn't really work. I mean, it worked in the short term.
It gave
term.
You the illusion that you were solving your problems.
Right. And there was consequences always attached to it. I mean, when I was growing up, I had a jar on my shelf next to my sports trophies that had teeth in it. Because every day after school, I'd be fighting from people going, and, you know, and it was just miserable. And there was lots of days that I came home crying, you know, that they were, you know, and back in them days.
Who's other people's teeth?
Yeah. Children's, you know, the.
People, but your people your age.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. The people that were going,
And you just pop them right in the mouth and their teeth would fall out.
Well,
or you'd hit them with something and their teeth would fall out.
Yeah, or they'd get on the ground and you could stomp them. And back then, I mean, we're talking 1970s in the city of New York. It's not like California where if you point your finger at somebody the wrong way, they're calling the police. Back in New York, a fight between two boys was standard. It was part of the, you know, the program. It was, you know, so it wasn't like, you know, and it wasn't lawsuit happy California either, where their parents were coming over saying, we're going to take it. You know, it didn't work like that.
So no parents ever came over to your parents and said, your kid knocked my kid's teeth out?
No, never. I mean, I was asked to leave school one time. You know, but for the most part, these things happened off school property.
Yeah.
On the way home, I mean, it was set up during the day. You know, you knew you was going to fight that kid at the end of the day. And all of the school children would go and watch. And it was, you know, and I'd come home and me and my mom.
How many teeth did you have in the jar?
I don't know, you know. But I know that there was, you know, maybe an inch and a half's worth in the bottom of this jar. And I remember coming home and showing my mom.
Good God.
The different teeth at times, and I'd laugh and I'd say, look, this guy had a cavity in here, because there was all kind, you know, like there was the front ones and there was the bicuspids and there was the little pointy one here on the side and there was, you know, there was all different kinds of
ones. So you were either going to be a criminal or a dentist, one of the two. Your path was
extraction.
Your path was set.
You know, I mean, I even get a little warm talking about it, because those were bad times for me. I mean, you know, and I'm sure that those things that happened then, I carried through my adult years. And, you know, I mean, that was a very traumatic time for me. I mean,
What is the warm feeling about? The fact that you were protecting yourself?
No, I think it's the feelings of.
You mean a good warm feeling or a bad warm feeling?
No, a bad warm feeling.
Oh, okay.
It just kind of talking about it, you know, because I don't talk about that often.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that was the worst part of my life, that couple-year period when kids were just so, you know, mean, you know. I said it was awful. I mean, that, you know, that probably led to my use of drugs, because all of a sudden that leveled the playing field and I was included, or the illusion. Yeah.
That's so funny that you mentioned that, because I remember distinctly going freshman year. I had it with Catholic grade school. All my friends were going to the Catholic high school. I was tired of uniforms and nuns. I said, I'm going to go to the public high school. Thought I'd be able to make friends. I couldn't. Turns out the only people that would hang around with me were burnouts. So I started smoking weed, and I remember distinctly thinking to myself, these people are just hanging around each other, and me specifically, because I've got drugs. There is a false friendship here that is really subpar, but I'm going to have to accept it because there really isn't anything better for me. Do you feel like that was something that kind of went through your mind, or was the illusion that this is great and this is exciting?
I think I just like the fact that now I was a part of.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel like I was that kid with the stuttering problem.
Mm-hmm.
Once the drug started, I was accepted by that crew. And then shortly, sometime after that, I don't even really recall. I'd have to ask my mom and dad when that happened, that my speech problem went away.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't really think much about my speech problem until that movie where that guy won the Academy Award, the King's Speech.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I mean, that was me at a young age.
Wow.
Oh, my God, that was me. I mean, I seen that movie, and I was in the theaters, and I started to get that same warm feeling.
Yeah.
You know, and I was just like, you know, I mean, it was a, it was a difficult thing. But the weed and the alcohol just kind of made it all, you know, that rushed over me, and I didn't feel, different.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like, yes, this is my elixir.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Now I'm good.
Okay, so then what led to beginning to commit crimes? Was it just because the group you were running around with, it was those guys that you looked up to? Were those the people that you had started hanging around with?
Well, yeah, it was no secret in the neighborhood that I was always fighting.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, that brought out the other people, and everybody knows everybody in the neighborhood. And I used to see these certain guys, and I was asked one time, I guess I was 17, and by this time I'm already selling narcotics, and I got me a little name.
Mm-hmm.
And I was approached.
When you say narcotics, what, heroin?
No, it was cocaine, weed, mm-hmm. mescaline, mm-hmm. you know, smaller type things at that time. Well, the cocaine wasn't small, it was jumping at that time.
And you were dealing small quantities, large quantities?
Small quantities.
Yeah.
And I was approached by this guy who I had seen around, and he asked me, did I want to do something a little bigger?
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to this bar, and we sat down, and he started to talk to me. And he said, look, he says, if you get in here, he says, you're in the major leagues. He says, you know, things will change for you. And I was like, wow. You know, because growing up, I think unconsciously, I had always, you know, like I said, I didn't want to be an astronaut or anything like that. I wanted to be one of them. And being in a crime syndicate had a certain,
mm-hmm.
you know, attraction to me.
Yeah.
And when he asked me, did I want to get in? And I was like, well, yeah, I want to get in. And then I went home and I talked it over with my brother, and he said...
Older brother, younger
yeah,
brother?
Yeah, older brother. He says, you don't want to get in that, Jimmy. And I said, hey, I says, things will change for me. You know, and I was always the one who had to defend myself, and I knew that if I got on this team, now all of a sudden, I am somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas for all those years, I wasn't anybody. I was just this little redheaded kid with a stuttering problem
mm-hmm.
who had to fight his whole way and, you know, would go home crying some days. Mm-hmm. Here was a chance for me to turn it all around and be somebody, which was, you know, now, you know, that I think about it 30 years later,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Half of it spent in jail.
It was a lie.
Yeah.
You know, so when they came to me and asked me, you know, and of course I was like, well, how is this going to work? I can't possibly get in because I'm an Irishman.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up working on a crew, and they called me a Tritalian.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because pretty much that's who I hung out with. Most of my friends were Italian. You know, we were in an Italian-Irish neighborhood in mm-hmm. New York, so it's just what we did. There was numbers being run and all of that kind of stuff. Like, you know, similar to what you see in that movie, A Bronx Tale,
mm-hmm.
with Robert De Niro. I mean,
yeah.
I can relate to that story
yeah.
a whole lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had a penchant for violence, and I can tell you that not only psychologically did it appear to solve my problems, but I kind of enjoyed it and got off on the power surge, the rush, the, you know.
The false respect.
Yeah, all of that. And then when I got with these guys, one of the first things that this guy told me, he says, you know what? He says, you don't ever have to fight again. He says, as long as you have, I think he said 20 cents, because at that time it was 20 cents to make a pay phone call.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been a dime. Was it a dime?
Yeah.
It was either a dime or 20 cents. And he said, all you need to do is make a phone call. And I was like, really? And then I was given this one bar that was mine. And, you know, I was, you know, and really, I mean, they were just setting me up. I mean, I didn't know it, but I was mm-hmm. being used,
mm-hmm.
you know, but I thought I was somebody. And, you know, I bought in.
Right.
You know, and I was all good with it. You know, I mean, there was little perks involved, and, you know, the word got around the neighborhood, hey, you know who, you know, Murph is hanging out with, and, you know, I'd be on this side of the bar with, you know, other important people,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it was just, you know, my brother was like, I asked him after I had gotten in, as far as I could get in for an Irishman, I came home and I asked him, I says, hey, Tom, I says, I can get you in if you want to get in. And he said the smart thing. He was my older brother. Mm-hmm. He said, why do I need to get in if you're in? And I said,
wow.
You know, and that's how that went.
So when did your plan begin to start backfiring on you?
God, it didn't take long. It was, you know, I don't know specifics here because it's a time in my life that was a big blur. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, I'm under the influence, you know, this whole time.
Was heroin ever a drug for you?
Yeah, but we only used heroin. I mean, it was the white stuff. We used to call it doogie back in them days, and we used to only sniff it to come down from the cocaine.
Mm. Cocaine was your major drug of choice?
Well, it was the major drug that I started out with. I mean, I don't consider weed and mescaline and
right.
mushrooms and all that stuff. You know, that was just like hors d'oeuvres.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the main ones was the cocaine, the heroin, the mm-hmm. methamphetamine. Those was your meal.
Right.
You know, the rest of it was hors d'oeuvres. Right. You know, little stuff in the candy dish, some mushrooms, some mescaline, some acid. That was just, you know, makeup, you know.
Yeah.
And it was cocaine, and we were freebasing it back then. I mean, this is when you couldn't even buy a rock on the street. You know, right. There was no such thing.
So this was the late 70s, early 80s
yeah.
then. Yeah. Richard Pryor set yourself on fire years.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and it was $300 an 8-ball, $2,800 an ounce. I mean, it was very
expensive.
Very, very expensive yeah. at that time. It was the time of Studio 54 mm-hmm. and the Mud Club and CBGB.
Were you ever providing drugs to those people?
I provided drugs all over. I was sent many times in a limousine to Atlantic City mm-hmm. to deliver narcotics. I mean, I shouldn't use the names, but let's just say there was at least three big Motown acts mm-hmm. that I handed off drugs to. There was a lot of people in that circle. You'd be surprised. I mean,
yeah.
I was always surprised.
Yeah.
I was like, who?
Yeah.
I was like, really?
Yeah.
I was always surprised.
So one of the parts of your past that fascinates me is the bank robbery. How many banks have you robbed?
I walked into one, and one was burglarized.
Oh, so just two?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because I thought it was this history of bank robberies. Walk me through both of them and the setup, the planning, what you were feeling, what was going through your mind.
Well,
all of that.
I can tell you this: the main feeling was fear and terror. I was scared every single time.
So it wasn't your idea. You were part of a crew that was going to do it.
Right, right, right.
Okay. And what was your role in the robbery?
In the walk-in robbery, the door was my responsibility.
The front door?
Yeah. Two other guys handled the other stuff because one guy was brought in from Texas, and he had a history of doing these things.
Mm-hmm.
So it was him and his henchmen, and me, I was the new guy, and the guy out in the car was the new guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
just like the movies.
Yeah, it was training.
And the guy in the car is the fuck up, right?
Well.
That's what it always is in the movies. He's, you know, looking at his watch or, you know, he is up too late the night before and he falls asleep in the getaway car.
Well, they're always going to kill the guy in the movies who
yes.
makes the least amount of money first.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you got to keep the stars around.
Right.
The star is never the getaway driver.
Right.
Unless it's the Fast and the Furious or something like that.
So you're at the door and you're guarding the door. And what are you supposed to do?
You know what?
If shit goes down, are you supposed to shoot people? Or what do they tell you?
What they tell me and what I was willing to do was always two different things. I mean, I wanted to do what they wanted to do, and I wanted to be what they wanted to be, but I wanted to minimize, you know, I didn't want to do, you know, I wasn't a psychopath. I just, you know, I mean, you know, it was fun and exciting and it was a rush, mm-hmm. but with as little collateral damage as possible. You know, I mean,
well, I would think 99% of criminals feel that way too. And that's probably what they tell themselves. You know, I think a lot of people that commit crimes or are engaging in behavior that is immoral, they kid themselves in saying, I don't, you know, it's not my intention to do this. They judge themselves by their intentions and not by their actions. And that's how I think a lot of times for me, I lied to myself for years by saying, well, it wasn't my intention, you know, to do this, to be a fuck up, to be an asshole or a drunk or, you know, lie or cheat or, you know, do whatever. But, you know, you find yourself sometimes, not living up to your intentions and cutting yourself some slack instead of really taking a good hard look at who you've really become.
Well, I would go in hoping that it would go easy and it mm-hmm. would go well.
And did it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank God for that, you know, because my life and my career could have been, I mean, I might not, I mean, I'm so blessed to just be sitting here talking about this in this house and in this life that I lead now. It's just, it's an absolute blessing. But I would hope that it would go well. But at the same time, I was willing to do whatever it took mm-hmm. to succeed at the mission.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I was always able.
We're going to pause for a second.
I was always able to compartmentalize my feelings, you know, and I always, my mantra was, it's business, it's nothing personal.
Mm-hmm. Your dog snoring is just killing me.
Well, I'm glad she's comfortable. I mean, this is really...
this is hard for you to talk about.
Well, I haven't talked about it in this kind of detail in a long time. It's part of, I mean, have I confessed to God and done all of that? Yeah, but I, you know, I'm absolutely different. Mm-hmm. You know, 30 years later, at that time, those guys were like my heroes and my role models.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to be like them and I wanted to ascend this criminal ladder and I wanted to be the best possible criminal that I could be. And I wanted the reputation. And I wanted the girls, and I wanted the mm-hmm. money, and I wanted the cars, and I knew that I was only going to live to 35, and I was good with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, have I shed a lot of tears behind the things I did when I was young? I absolutely have.
Mm-hmm.
Am I sorry for it all? Yeah. Sorry enough to go and throw myself on the mercy of the court? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess that discounts all of it. I guess I'm really not sorry. You know,
I don't know if that's necessarily the case. I could be wrong, but I look at you and I see somebody who has turned their life around and is of use to society now, whereas they were a cancer on society. You're sober now, and you know, I see you inspire people who are struggling to get sober, and you show people that it's never too late to turn your life around and become a person that you thought you could never be, because I can't picture you doing these things. I can intellectually, because, you know, you got the tough street guy voice from New York. But, you know, the Murph that I know you talking about your girlfriend and how beautiful your life is together and how you want to be a better man for her and how when your neighbor bitches about the hedges that you hold your tongue instead of you know, not only do you not pull a gun out and not threaten them, you don't even lose your temper around them. And to me, that's a person who has value in society, because you can inspire other people and say, you know what, you can be a decent, upstanding citizen, and it doesn't mean that you're a punk, and you can live with yourself as long as you become of use to society. I think, and maybe I'm wrong here, but if you hadn't started helping people and being an inspiration to them by helping other guys who are trying to get sober, do you think that you yourself would be able to live with yourself? Do you think you'd go back to doing drugs or committing crimes?
Well, I know if I didn't admit my wrongs,
yeah,
you know, and try to, you know, leech them out of my system, and you know, admit to them and tell somebody else about them, you know, because keeping those secrets is difficult.
Yeah,
you know, it's difficult.
I mean, it's got to eat at you.
You get good at it for years and years and years, and you know repress it so much, and you push it down there, and it's easier with drugs and alcohol when you're pouring that kind of stuff on it. Mm-hmm. But
that catches up to you eventually.
Yeah, when you take away the drugs and alcohol, then you have to deal with all of this stuff.
So what would you tell? The chances are probably rare that there's a psychopathic drug addict listening to this podcast right now. But what would you say to a kid? It's maybe 16, 17. He's starting to run in those circles. He's got a little voice inside of him that's saying this is headed someplace bad, but he doesn't know what else to do. What advice would you give him? Because he's getting off on the power of it, and maybe he's feeling picked on, he's feeling powerless, and he doesn't know where to turn. Is there anything that you would say? Let's say you had a little brother that looked like he was following in your shoes, what would you tell him? Pull out a gun and threaten him?
No, you know it. Whatever I would say probably wouldn't work, because when you're, you know, for me, when I was that young, the peer pressure and the, you know, I mean, only after I, you know, got a little older and I learned from these mistakes and I was able to look back and say, good Lord, what did I do all that for it? You know, that has enabled me, you know, to make the choices that I make today, because back then I didn't believe what I was doing was inappropriate or, you know, incorrect. My morals had just disappeared with drugs, and you know, I mean, so you know, what would I tell somebody who was heading down the same path that I headed down? Well, I'd probably start out by telling them, you're making a mistake. You know, everything you think is good right now is, you know, you may not be as lucky as I am.
Do you think describing prison life in detail to them, just describes the shitty parts of prison life in detail, if you would.
The shitty parts of prison life.
As opposed to the great parts.
The shitty parts of prison life. Well, first off would be no females. I mean, there is sex available, you know, dependent on, you know, who you are and, you know, what you're willing to live with.
You want to elaborate on that? Or are you not comfortable?
Well, you know, I mean, there's sex going on in prison. You can believe that.
Yeah, I think everybody knows that.
Most of it is willing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there is that saying that, if you bend them over and put a Playboy book on their lower back, every asshole looks the same. So, you know, some might have a little bit more hair than others. I mean, I ain't never seen a female with a hairy asshole, but there's razors, you know. Other bad parts. Well, you push your tray along the chow line and you get whatever lands on it. You know, there is no menu.
Mm-hmm.
Other bad parts, the politics for me. Some of the politics, you know, you don't agree with them, but when you're
but
in
you
got
to stick with your with your race, because that's a survival mechanism in prison, right?
It's, right.
You don't choose whether or not you're going to hang out with the white guys. You're there. There's no other option. It's
well, no.
Am I wrong in that?
Yeah. No, I mean, you can choose who you want to hang out with, but if you don't hang out with your own, you're looked down on by your own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and my personal opinion is if you're white and if you hang out with the blacks, you're not getting the full black experience either.
Right.
Because you're not black.
Right.
They know it. We know it.
Mm-hmm.
You're not getting any love from us because we're thinking you're a race traitor.
Right.
You know, I mean, for us, someone's probably going to get you.
Right.
You know, because you make, you know, the mentality in there, God, I mean, I, you know, all of these things, you know, the crime, the jails, all of this. I have trouble talking about it today for the simple reason of I am so far removed from that today that, you know, how and.
But you've also only been out of prison for what, 5 years?
Right.
But spiritually, you're so far removed from it.
Right.
Talk about the importance of a spiritual belief in your life, if you can, or is that difficult for you to talk about?
Well, I'm not. You know, I have a spiritual life today. It's not as good as I'd like it to be. No, I really can't. You know, I really can't talk about that in depth. I mean, I feel it, and I know it exists in my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but can I tell you or your listeners about it? No, I mean, I have one. I know it exists. It's with me every day.
Mm-hmm.
I talk to him every day. But I always had a concept of God. I mean, I was raised Roman Catholic. I mean, I went to church every single Sunday until I was old enough to say, nope, I'm not going Sunday morning.
Oh, wasn't that the greatest?
Because there's a football game on.
Isn't that the greatest? Well, for me, I started getting high and instead of going to CCD, and that was the best trade-off in the world because while I believe in God, organized religion was always, for me, Catholicism, that God was just too much of a vengeful God for me to wrap my head around and to feel loved by. And I think for a long time I let that definition of God push me away from believing that there is something out there. Now, I don't believe that there is a conscious entity up there with a beard, you know, saying this person's going to go here. I believe in energy in the universe that we can either ignore and have a more difficult life and swim upstream, or we can align ourselves with it by listening to our conscience and have a much more fluid, easy life. That to me is my concept of God. But and I guess the reason I'm saying this is I don't want to alienate people who are listening to this podcast and say, oh, this is going to be a religious a podcast. It, you know, that is not my intention. You know, I'm probably prejudiced against organized religion to a degree that I need to be more open-minded towards it. I still have some bitterness towards Catholicism, but... You know, that's my own issue. But I think they're all the same. They're different doors leading into the same room, which is aligning yourself with the universe. You know, so if people get it through church, I think that's awesome. If you get it through yoga or meditation or, you know, whatever. I think that's all.
As long as you believe in something, I mean.
Something greater than yourself in the pursuit of your own pleasure.
Right.
That, I think, in our society, I think it is one of the biggest dead ends, is we think that if we just directly pursue our own pleasure at the expense of other things and other people, that that's okay and there will be more pleasure. But what we find out is we're going against the grain of the universe, because the universe wants us to think about other people. And then the byproduct of that is that we get to experience not only pleasure, but peace of mind and the freedom that comes with believing that we're leading a good life and we're good, honest people. And I think that's one of the reasons that I like you so much, is I see you live in that, and it's such a miracle. It to me, it's a proof that there's an energy in the universe that can do amazing things if you choose to learn a new way of life, be vulnerable, open up, talk about the bad things that you've did to another human being, and try to think about other people. You know, let's look at this woman that's in your life. Talk a little bit about your life here in this beautiful house.
Well, I met this woman probably 3 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and she's an angel. She knew that I was on the construction at the time.
You were a fixer-upper when she found you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
See, but
she must be into tank tops, I'll tell you that much, because I think the first time I saw you wear sleeves was at a wedding, and I'm not even sure, you know, I wasn't even sure you were going to put sleeves on for that.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
You know what? I was definitely a fixer-upper, but I think what she saw is the same thing that most of my friends today see, and that's the person that, or the product of ages 1 through 16.
Yeah.
I was raised in a good home with all the morals, the principles, and all of those things that a normal, you know, adult, you know, mature human being should have. And then from 16 to 44, I made my own choices, totally discounted all of that stuff, the nurturing that I had learned in the nest. And now that the drugs and alcohol have been gone for 5 years, in these 5 years, I have reverted back mm-hmm. to those things that I learned from 1 to 16. That's what she sees. That's what I believe my friends see today. I just took a little vacation.
It's funny because your previous vacations, you know, used to be behind bars. That's how
right.
That's how the criminals refer to it. I took a little 6-year yeah. vacation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go to my parents' house and look around the living room, and there's photos, you know, and they're chronologically, you know, and there's Christmases, and there's, oh, at this wedding, and this, and, you know, and there's the baby pictures, and it starts, and there I am. I'm in all, you know, growing up, and I'm on an elephant in this one, and I'm in this, la, 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 I'm next to my brother there. And then when we start to be, when we start to be 20 something, you go one wall in the house and there's all the pictures and I'm not there.
Wow.
And then the next wall in the house, I'm not on that one either, but everybody else is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you would think that I had died.
Yeah.
And then finally I've resurfaced and now I'm on, you know, so that's where I took a vacation and I wasn't me.
Yeah.
For all those years.
The true you.
Right. And now I'm back to who I am. That's what she saw in me, because there was no way that I could land a woman like this.
Right.
You know.
She would have sensed yeah. instantly.
Well, she sensed that that there might have been a somewhat checkered past.
Oh, is that the understatement of the century? You think the prison tattoos and the hardened look in the eye, you think?
Yeah, well, she told me I had a terrible haircut, and she says you dress penitentiary chic. That's what she called it. And I was thinking to myself, did this bitch just tell me that I got a fucked up hairdo and that she doesn't like the way I dress?
Yeah.
You know, and that just made her more attractive to me, because I wasn't used to being talked to like that.
Yeah.
But She's an angel. You know, when I met her, I had never been in a healthy relationship.
Yeah.
All of my relationships were very superficial, you know.
Probably because it was all about you and what you were getting.
Yeah, and it wasn't a relationship. I mean, I don't know what the time constraint is to, you know, for it to be a relationship. But most of them were, you know, I'm sure there were some of them short-lived relationships where I'd be hard-pressed to remember your name.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't really caring what your name was. I was caring about one thing, and then as soon as that happened or I got that, it was see you later, bye. I got something to do.
Yeah.
You know, back in those days, I couldn't have had a healthy relationship with a houseplant.
Yeah.
She's awesome. I love her to death. As a matter of fact, in these 3 years that we've been together, she told me it would be like this. I didn't believe it when she first told me this.
Mm-hmm.
She said, it will get better. And I was like, what do you mean it'll get better? You know, and she's right.
Yeah.
Every day it seems to get better. And I've never been in anything quite as feely as this. You know, I mean, this is, you know, and I'm, you know, I mean, I'm new at this too. You know, she teaches me all about these things. And, God bless her. I mean, she's been a great influence in my life. She's quick to point out in a very nice way, some other things that she thinks I should work on.
Yeah.
To, you know, to better my character. And she says them in such a way where I don't bow up and get crazy. I, you know, it might hurt or sting at the time she says it, but I usually don't fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fight her too much on it, because my personal opinion is if most of the people in this world acted the way she acted, it would be a really, really cool place to live.
Wow.
I believe that about her so much that
you trust her instincts.
Right. That when she convinced me that I need to vote, and I told her, I says, vote? What do I need to vote for? No matter who you pick, they're lying to us, and then when they get in there, the status quo in Washington is going to be what it is, and nothing ever gets done, so why do I need to vote? But she convinced me to vote, and I believe in her so much that I let her punch my thing, too, because I figure whoever she's voting for, you know, based on the person she is, is good enough for me. It would make a nice world.
Wouldn't that be funny if that's what you got arrested for, was letting her vote for you?
Yeah. I hope I never get arrested again. I mean, today I
can. But you haven't committed any crimes since you've been sober in 5 years. The closest the closest you came was kicking a guy in the balls that challenged you on the freeway.
Yeah, well, I had a fight on the freeway, and I did go into someone else's living room uninvited because they owed me money from a job.
Mm-hmm. A legitimate job, a legal job.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Construction.
Do I think that's of a criminal nature? No, I don't. I thought I was well within my rights, but what I think and what the law thinks is two different things. No. I don't break the laws anymore. You know, I mean, there was a time in my life, a lot of years, where I thought it was impossible to go through a day and not break the law. I was like, how do you do that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the life I was leading, drugs and violence and crime, it was a necessary evil. I mean, you know, you carried a gun every day.
Yeah.
Today, no, I don't do crimes. I walk when the sign says walk. I stop when it says stop. I really kind of lead a Ward Cleaver kind of life. I mean, I got a 14-year-old, not mine. He's hers. And,
but you're a role model for him. I hear you talk about him and it's funny, 'cause you're closer to him than my own father was to me. The stuff that you share with him and the way you nurture him and the way you, guide him and the interest that you take in his life, you know, which just shows to me, you know, family, and it's kind of a cliche, but, you know, family is who you choose, not who you're tossed in with. Well, not that I don't love my family, but, you know.
It's a funny twist what happened here, because I had a good childhood. And then, you know, when I got to be 16, 17, I put that on hold and I went and I did my own thing. Whereas this kid that I have now, he lost his father. His father wasn't a criminal. His father was an alcoholic. And his father was clean for a little while and then decided to have just one drink. Thought having one drink was a good idea. And that one drink turned into many drinks. And those many drinks turned into a blackout. And then he carjacked a RV. And then he was on one of those TV shows going through roadblocks and everything. Long story short.
Doesn't he know there is no worse car, getaway car, than an RV? He should go to jail just for that.
Well, I mean, when you're in a blackout, you know, I mean, who knows what anybody's thinking. Mm-hmm. But long story short, he ended up killing two people. He got 40 to life and a life sentence in California. I don't think anybody has paroled ever from a life sentence in California, at least not in the last 30 years. So he's never coming home. So that kind of makes me, you know, that whole picture kind of makes me believe that this isn't an accident.
Yeah.
You know, me meeting my girl and then me being tossed into this, who had a good childhood, so and who had good parenting, despite my adult decisions for all those years. Here's this youngster who has had a good childhood minus a role model.
Yeah.
And then here I come, who knows how to teach this kid from the age of 0 to 17.
Yeah.
And he's only 14.
Yeah.
So I can teach him what I know because I know something about that.
And you know how to spot a bullshitter because you're,
well,
you know.
Yeah.
You can't bullshit a bullshitter.
And I was a good student as a child. You know, my dad saw to it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, despite my track record, you would think that I, you know, that I had bad parenting. I did not.
Yeah.
You know, I have three siblings, and they're, you know, good citizens. They get citizenship awards.
Yeah.
Me, I never got one of those. You know, but.
Well, you're heading in the right direction.
The game ain't over yet. I might, you know, I might get one here.
Well, dude, I want to thank you so much for opening it up and, letting me, let me interview you. I know some of this was hard, but I think people will, at the very least, find it interesting and entertaining, and hopefully somebody listening out there will hear this and become inspired by you. But you know, this may sound cheesy, but you inspire me, and I'm proud to call you my friend. So thanks, buddy.
Well, thanks, Paul. It was nice being here.
All right, now get that fucking pug out of my face. And don't forget to go to the website, mentalpod.com. You could also type in mentalillnesshappyhour.com, but you might get writer's cramp. So go check it out. Read the message board. Post. Ask questions. Answer questions. Take a survey. Get crazy. Or stare at the wall with your jaw open.